It is time for the Media Beat. David Taranchuk joins us on a weekly basis on a Friday. He's a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief. He's got his own great website, themediabeat.us, and let's see if David's there. Are you there, David?
Well, I'm here, yes. I'm glad to be reporting in from the great state of Maine again, in a continuing break from my home base in the media capital of the world, New York City. Or, as I read in a Canadian novelist, a novelist's work, when we read Canadian novels in Maine, the novelist labeled it that New York City was the global capital of degeneracy.
well, that's
fiction, of course. In real life, I'm very happy to be once again discussing the week's news coverage with the unendingly sharp Marshall Miles. I'm sorry if you've been having communications problems, but I'm glad to be with you.
Well, you know, that New York might have been replaced in that by Los Angeles by now. You never can tell.
I mean, I've been replaced by anywhere.
That's exactly right. Well, we've got a lot of interesting things to cover about the media covering it, and the presidency of Joe Biden, which has been kind of just wafting along, and not, all of a sudden you turn around. And here's a Democratic president who's 80 years old. He has basically put together three huge pieces of legislation that they finally managed to get together, which is a lot of what he was talking about. I mean, the final piece just went into place, which is a $470 billion plan, and people are upset because it's not enough. Well, you know, $470 billion used to be a lot. Now if it's not $1 billion, people think it's not a lot. But you know what? I think that Joe Biden has now has a lot to stand on his first term in office, especially with the 50-50 split in the Senate and the House the way it is. You know, you turn around and all of a sudden, the quiet Joe Biden has succeeded in a lot of different things.
Sure, it's a key time in United States politics, Marshall. I think you're right. But, you know, however successful Biden might be, he has the chance, at least a strong chance, of having his toe stubbed seriously, because this, of course, is midterm year, and this particular week it's been kind of unusually a big primaries day in August, somewhat unusual. June is the most frequent month for primaries, not August, and the media, of course, have kicked into overdrive to cover the results and draw out what nationwide significance each of the local state primaries might have. All politics is local, they say, in their hallowed phrase, but the press is always determined to generalize from the local. And it's with some good cause in some of the instances of these primaries. It's hard not for us to wonder, as Americans, not as members of a particular state or residents of a particular state, what we should take away from how the people of Kansas voted. A vote there, which was expressly about a national issue, abortion rights. This was the first electoral test of the overturning of the 50-year-old Roe v. Wade precedent, the overturning by the current U.S. Supreme Court. And the question put to Kansans was pretty damn clear. Let me quote the ballot paper. Should the Kansas Constitution be amended to remove protections of abortion rights? And we know the result. Kansas is, of course, a deep red state, but its voters on this issue delivered a loud warning shot to Republicans right across the country, signaling that abortion has the potential to energize voters in the Democratic favor, who the Republicans had hoped would just remain disengaged. I mean, a little forlorn hope, I think, now. Democrats are very likely to use the vote to try and build momentum and to to depict Republicans as out of step with the majority of Americans on the issue. It was interesting to see the New York Times exercise extrapolation, essentially, was the name of the game. You might think it somewhat dubious, perhaps an overreaching stretch, but the Times statistical expert, Matt Cohen, calculated that 4 out of 5 states in the Union would vote the same way as Kansas if they were offered the same choice. We may soon have the fullest breakdown by party loyalty, but it was pretty clear early on that the strength of the abortion rights side wasn't limited to Democratic areas in Kansas. The pro-choice vote was clear, not only in moderate and increasingly blue areas like the city, so Kansas City itself, in the suburbs of that city, but also in certain very conservative parts of the state. And of course, swing areas in the state swung, that's what they do, as you'd expect. And this time they swung very definitely towards the abortion rights side. So as we look ahead to the November general elections, many analysts around the media are naturally concluding that the battleground states like Pennsylvania, Georgia, and Arizona could help decide the future of abortion rights, and might even, and this is a big political picture with a capital P for party on politics, it might even swing the midterms in the Democrats' favor, and that 50-50 split you're talking about in the Senate might actually go the Democrats' way, and the majority, existing majority, small though it is, in the House would be increased. That's a long shot, I know, and even Democrats are acknowledging the truth of how long a shot it is. Midterms are almost always a referendum on the current national administration and President Joe Biden's numbers, despite the pretty extraordinary legislative success he's able to score now, and you were pointing that out very clearly. His numbers are looking inescapably unencouraging. On the other hand, there are 3 months to go before the November elections. And if you're interested on the Republican side, well, the obvious takeaway from the primaries for them is that the pro-Trump faction continues to make ground. In this week's primaries, Republicans were selecting as candidates for November people who are still claiming, against all the evidence, that the 2020 election was stolen. Now, whether they get elected by American voters in general, and whether they get sent to sit in the U.S. Congress is an entirely different matter. It's still too early to say if we're likely to end up with a pro-Trump Congress, though, of course, that risk still remains. And in some ways, it appears to be growing with the incursion of more and more Trump-endorsed candidates, as was the case in Tuesday's results. So thinking about Congress, Marshall, we can't let the week go by without wondering about the congressional speaker, the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, third in line to the president, as the press keeps on reminding us this week. Has she been hitting the hustings to ensure that her Democratic caucus protects and even might increase, as I was suggesting it might, its majority in the November vote? No, she has not. As you know, she's been operating on a wider canvas, getting the international media's attention for her visit to Taiwan.
You know, I questioned the visit to Taiwan, but then I did some research and found that many, many years ago, a Republican leader of the House visited Taiwan. Newt Gingrich, with full support of his Republican House and Senate, visited Taiwan. Now, the reaction with China is also stunningly amazing, because you're looking at a country, China, that has completely reneged on the deal it set up with Hong Kong, completely, absolutely, totally reneged on it. And their reaction was to fire missiles in every direction around Taiwan except at Taiwan, not only angering Japan, and then to put all these sanctions in against the United States. I know that they have to show some sort of strength to their countrymen, but these are dangerous times.
Yeah, and at the heart of it is Speaker Pelosi, I think her position is critical to how this went. I mean, she's not Newt Gingrich. It is interesting to see that even Mitch McConnell in, on the Republican side of the Senate was praising the visit. There's some degree of bipartisanship here when it comes to, you know, taking a stand against China, or at least making a making a symbolic gesture against them. I mean, despite all that furore that was stoked by the Communist Party, and as you suggest, a somewhat hypocritical way, and a lot of Western press, jumping on the bandwagon, saying that this is a really unwise and provocative visit, Speaker Pelosi went ahead with the trip. And that's entirely in tune with her very long history of being of outspokenness, really, on China. She's often told reporters that she, I think the phrase she used was second to none in the Congress for her stand against China's human rights abuses. And it's been valuable this week to see visual media bringing up some of her earlier protests. We all remember those horrific killings of protesters in Tiananmen Square in 1989, those of us old enough to do so, at least. Well, Pelosi was still newly elected to the House from California at that point. She represents probably the safest Democratic district in the country. But not long after, on the second anniversary of the massacre in 1991, she was on that parliamentary-style visit to Beijing, and she slipped the leash on her communist guards, went to the square, and unfurled a banner proclaiming support for those killed. They died for democracy, I remember, was her message. The police stepped in, of course, and the kerfuffle stirred controversy. I recall Mike Choi, the CNN's veteran China correspondent, a fluent Mandarin speaker, very well placed in his coverage of communist China and the changes in that country's policies at the time. He was arrested because he was covering the Pelosi protest, of course. And he wrote afterwards that it was a sign of Pelosi's recklessness going ahead with her protest. Quote, whatever the consequences, that has echoes now, doesn't it? He wasn't exactly impartial himself, of course. He was the one who got arrested. She, as a visiting dignitary, did not get arrested. But that caution about the Chinese, about how to deal with a bullying regime like the big mainland Chinese dragon, does have its echoes now. And wariness about offending the communist Chinese is again being prompted by Pelosi's boldness. And it's interesting to see that Joe Biden, as president, didn't criticize Pelosi. Not directly, anyway, but he did say that the United States military didn't like the idea of the visit. And inevitably, as you say, now we have seen the Chinese military doing more than rattling sabers, actually using them. It's circling the island of Taiwan with live fire war exercises. So tensions are undoubtedly rising, as it periodically does around Taiwan. The Taiwanese are very, very used to this. No one on any side in this situation wants a war, it's being said, for all the military exercises. And now, very sort of specific sanctions imposed by China on Pelosi herself and her family. But the, you know, the, I guess the hard, the rattling of the hardware is possibly the most worrying thing. Very close to key ports and military installations in Taiwan. But let's hope that that notion of nobody really wants a war will hold true.
It's a very busy time for American media and world media as well. Let's switch over to the sentence for the American woman basketball player, 9.5 years. Obviously, that sentence was put into effect, and now Russia will put up the pressure to get the two for prisoner swap.
Well, who knows what the mathematical calculation will be in the end? But I think, as we were saying last week, it's pretty well bound to end up with an asymmetric settlement. It's been pretty clear from the ASEAN conference and being held in Cambodia at the moment that at foreign minister level, that is our the United States Secretary of State and the foreign minister of Russia, they're not actually talking directly to each other, but they're talking pretty clearly in the open about each other's position, and there is clearly now what in diplomatic terms is called private channels connecting the two sides now as they talk specifically about a prisoner swap. So I guess it won't be too long, I hope not anyway, before an arrangement is arrived at, and Brittany Griner and the Marine will be freed and allowed to come home possibly a payment being made, if that's the right term, by the United States in the shape of more than just the notorious arms dealer who's in federal prison in the States right now. I think the 9-year sentence can be seen as something of a raising of the ante by the Russian side, and they will want more than just him. There's speculation, of course, but as we all know, that's the way these negotiations often go. And the other, by the way, you're right about it being a busy week for American news outfits. I mean, possibly the most sudden and dramatic news of the week was Ayman al-Zawahiri's death by drone strike. I mean, it was a remarkable tactical achievement by the CIA exercising its anti-terrorist covert action capacity as much as its intelligence role. That Hellfire missile hit, anti-terrorists are saying at least, maybe a welcome development in the 21-year campaign now to eliminate those responsible for the 9/11 attacks, but it didn't in itself show with any conclusiveness anyway that the United States can now readily respond to new threats emanating from Afghanistan under the Taliban. We are not on the ground; our intelligence sources are not of the ideal kind. Operating in the strategic term of the day, over the horizon. This was a very successful over the horizon attack, but you know, gathering the intelligence for any one who might be operating from, for instance, not downtown Kabul, as in this case, but you know, perhaps much more mobile terrorist cells in the hinterlands of Afghanistan. Keeping tabs on those, as there undoubtedly will be, all intelligence sources are suggesting that is going on with the Taliban, whatever they may have agreed to in the deal negotiated with the United States last year for withdrawal, not to allow terrorist threats to develop on their territory. Well, so much for that, huh? And you know, we mustn't forget the nature of the terrain. I'm talking about mobility in the hinterlands of the country. I think especially of Tora Bora, where Osama bin Laden was able to escape his American pursuers to then stay safe for another 10 years before he was finally killed on President Obama's watch.
And I guess we should come back to Alex Jones. And we talked about...
in a way, a Connecticut story, but a horrible, horrible, and in many ways, disgustingly sad story for the nation as a whole. That we can have in the realm of so-called broadcasting, that's the trade, I suppose, that Alex Jones is basically in. His outfit called InfoWars, its main spearhead being his regular broadcasting, it should be based on the kind of propaganda that defames the families of children killed in a mass shooting, accusing them of being actors and the whole thing being a hoax. Well, we've got the case results now. The trial is already over in terms of his guilt or otherwise. It's already been made clear that he's guilty of defamation, and he's already been fined over $4 million in what are called compensatory damages. But the trial does still continue in Austin, Texas. Texas being his base, and now what's being considered is not his guilt or otherwise. That's all settled. But now, what extra damages can be imposed against him? In this case, in a very appropriate legal terminology, punitive damages. Some measure of the court's feeling about the enormity of his. Of his offense here, and we can expect to see those numbers going very high. But the drama in the courtroom has been extraordinary. I mean, if you're going to defend yourself in a case like this, it's a really good idea to get good lawyers. But it seems that however much he's paying his lawyers, they still made a terrible, terrible mistake and handed over to the plaintiff's side. A whole tranche of texts, which internal communications, which are totally at odds with what Alex Jones and his lawyers have been claiming in the run-up to this trial. It's pathetic, and there's a sort of horrible comic dimension to it, which is kind of creepy. But I mean, the whole operation of InfoWars is a creepy exercise. As a journalist, I find really offensive.
And the one thing about a case like this is it serves notice, just like that case against the Ku Klux Klan, which and some of the white supremacist groups, where it took away their base and took away avenues to have money. This might put other websites that deal in such wild convictions, which were wrong, put them on notice that they're no longer safe.
Sure, the 20th century onslaught, that's what it was, by mainly the FBI against Ku Klux Klan chapters and branches was remarkably effective. I mean, the idea was to concentrate on the money, the old deep throat adage from the Watergate years. Follow the money is a sensible one if you want to get at the roots of an offensive operation, offensive in the sense that offenses are being committed, and in the sense that it offends ordinary human decency. I think. I'm not sure InfoWars will be wiped off the face of the planet now, but it's certainly going to be, in the literal sense of the word, very damaging. The damages are bound to be huge, and I hope it puts to rest fully. Although, of course, it won't in the minds of conspiracists throughout that crazy world. But I hope it puts paid to the whole idea of Sandy Hook being anything else than a terrible, terrible tragedy, a sickening tragedy that happened for real in a way that should never happen, but continues to happen in this country where mass shootings seem to be run of the mill.
Well, like I said, an interesting week for the media, and I'm sure next week won't disappoint us as well. David, we'll speak to you next week.
Look forward to that.
David Tarachuk with the Media Beat here on The Breakfast Club on Robinhood Radio. You can find David at themediabeat.us and on our website, robinhoodradio.com. Click on Demand. Click on David Tarachuk, The Media Beat.